Welcome to another episode of 30 Minutes in the New Testament. 30 Minutes in the New Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go over to 1517.org/podcast. Check out all the things we've got going on over there. While you're over there, you could go over to the donate page and you could support all the podcasts, this one and all the other ones. And not only these, it goes to support everything that we do, all the events, all the blogs, the academy, just everything that we do, all that media that we make for free and give to you. You can support that if it's been beneficial to you, because it's all listener supported. Everything that we do is listener supported. And if you are one of the ones that have gone over there and done that, thank you very much. You're making it all possible. Guys, we got events coming up. You know about Here We Still Stand. It's in October. There's not that many tickets left for that. And yeah, if you want to come, I recommend you get on that and you come on out. But also, just to throw it out there, we do have city events coming up. We have Austin, Texas, March 9th. We've got Des Moines, Iowa, April 13th. And we've got Minneapolis, Minnesota, May the 4th. You can go over to Christ Hold Fast, go to the city events page, get all the information. If you are in traveling distance of any of those places, Austin, Des Moines, Minneapolis, you should, in fact, get in your ride and come on over and hang out with me and whoever else happens to be at those events. Eric, here we are in Romans. We got stopped short last week. We have to backtrack a little bit, maybe we have to stay put for a second while we continue talking about two epic verses in verses 16 and 17 before moving on to the rest of the first chapter.
Yeah, this is the kind of thing. I mean, last week we did read verses 16 and 17 of chapter 1 and talked about it briefly. I mean, just a little bit. But because these are, I mean, I think almost every commentator agrees, really the theme verses for the book of Romans, you just can't move past them too quickly. We have to spend time really trying to dig into this and to dissect it. So we're going to camp here for a little while. We're going to have quite a bit of time on these two verses, and then we're going to get into, what will be some seemingly depressing verses for a while. I mean, Romans, basically from 1:18 all the way through the middle of chapter 3, it's not real optimistic.
Yeah, so Paul kind of gives this greeting. He talks about the power of the gospel being the means of salvation in life. And then from verses 18 in chapter 1 till about 3:20, mm-hmm. It's law, and he is going to talk about why we need the gospel, and that's really what he's doing. This is a classic sort of law gospel move that he's going to make. So it's going to be law. He's going to talk about sin. He's going to talk about the wrath of God against sin, and he's going to go into pretty great detail until we get to the middle of chapter 3, where he will then come in with the gospel. So. So bear with us. Get ready to be exposed. The law's coming in, and my friend, the law always, always accuses. But before we do that, we have a little more to say about what he prefaces it with. And so I do think it's interesting that Paul does make this sort of definitive gospel statement, this concise blast of gospel before he heads into this.
Yeah. Well, I think he wants people to know that ultimately, I mean, he wants his readers, the Romans, to know that this is where he's going, but he has to do some background work first. But this is what he wants. This is the purpose of the letter, to teach this. I mean, he refers to it. So let's start unpacking it a little bit. He says in verse 15, "I am eager to preach the gospel to you also who are in Rome, for I am not ashamed of the gospel." Now, there's some words in here that we can unpack just in what I read. But first of all, one of the ways to understand the gospel here when he talks about it is you could translate it, "I am not ashamed of my gospel," or "the gospel that I am preaching." And the reason that's significant is because there seems to be in the Roman church, and really throughout, I mean, because he didn't plant the Roman church, it was planted by somebody else, there seems to be some rumors that maybe Paul's gospel doesn't line up with the gospel that they've heard, or the gospel that that somebody else has told them. There seems to be some fear that there's a discrepancy. And so Paul wants to set out from the very beginning to say, no. I am eager to share my gospel, this powerful gospel that I'm preaching with you, just as much as I'm eager to share it with everybody else.
Yeah, and as uncomfortable as it might be, because we want, I mean, we talked about this a lot in Acts, but as uncomfortable as it may be, because we want everything to be all unified and clean and everybody on the same page all the time, the fact is that Paul did get pushback from the church. He was controversial.
Absolutely. Second Corinthians, he's dealing with the, quote, super apostles. The Galatians, the letter to the Galatians, he's dealing with people that are saying that his gospel is not right there. When we look in the book of Acts, we know that there's people that have come from the Jerusalem church that are accusing him of being antinomian-ish, you know. Mm-hmm. So his gospel is something that he has to sort of prove over and over again is indeed scriptural, biblical, is what God has actually given him to preach.
Right. Right. And so there's a question of it. When he says, I'm not ashamed of the gospel, why is there cause to be ashamed? What does he mean by that? And now a lot of people will say, you know, that, you know, you got to take a stand for Jesus or whatever and this sort of thing. And what they mean in our culture is more that you have to take some kind of moral stand on some social issue and be on the right side of it, you know, and you're going to stand with the Bible or whatever. Right. It's not what Paul's talking about here. What Paul's talking about is that he's not ashamed of this message that says that you must despair of all your righteousness and good works and cling only by faith to the absolute finished work of Christ, that his righteousness is all the righteousness that you need, and that anything other than that righteousness will find you wanting. There is something that's difficult about that. I mean, the gospel is an offense, and he will say this later on, but the offensive part of it is, and he's going to get into that in the rest of the chapter, is that he believes that you are such a sinner, his anthropology is so low, that he doesn't think that you have any righteousness whatsoever in any way. I mean, he's going to get into that none are righteous, no, not one, this sort of thing.
Yeah, that's really the crescendo of his argument in chapter 3 about humanity.
Right. So the law is offensive. We know that. I mean, it exposes us, calls us a sinner. No, it's uncomfortable. But then the gospel comes in and says that God will save you and you can't contribute.
Yes.
And that
and
is offensive.
There's nothing that offends the old Adam more than that.
Yes, that you are incapable of contributing to your own salvation. You cannot save yourself. And this is what he is not ashamed of. He is not ashamed of that message, that your goodness, that your righteousness, and that your works play no role in any of this, and that it is only the power of God that leads to salvation.
And it also could be when he says, for I am not ashamed of the gospel, it could be that he's saying, I'm not ashamed of the gospel that I'm preaching as, you know, as much as my opponents might make it seem like it's something I should be ashamed of. I'm proud of this gospel. I believe in it wholeheartedly. It could be that. And it also could be, I mean, and maybe this is just an effect of it. I mean, he's writing to a church that is probably at this point pretty tiny in this metropolitan, huge cultural hub that is Rome, you know, the capital of the world in the ancient world there. He's writing to Rome and he's saying, he's almost emboldening them to say, don't be ashamed of it too.
Yeah.
Because this is where you get to his first, there's two, in these two verses, there are two four statements, quote unquote, four statements in Greek gar, or,
because.
And it basically means like, because. And so he says, for I'm not ashamed of the gospel, for, or because, why? It is the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. So as much as you, this little church in Rome, feel like you might be insignificant, you might not be that powerful at this point, don't shrink back from preaching this message of the God who saves people purely by faith in Christ's finished work.
Right.
Don't be afraid to proclaim that. That's where God's doing his work. As he writes to the Corinthians in his first letter that we have in chapter 1, it's all about him saying, I decided to know nothing among you but Christ and him crucified. And it's for the same reason, because that's where the power of God is. And I think, you know, when you're small and you're insignificant or you feel insignificant, of course, there's a temptation to want to, you know, downplay whatever might be offensive in the law or in the gospel. You want to make it more palatable. You want to make it easier for people to digest. The idea of a crucified God is not something that's popular in the ancient world. And so this is sort of a call from Paul to say, like, no. Don't worry. Yeah, you're small right now, but this is where the power is.
Yeah. Yeah. Paul definitely believes in the efficacy of the preached gospel.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He's all about the preacher. And we're going to see, especially when we get to Romans 10, you know, where he declares faith comes by hearing and hearing through the word of Christ. I mean, he's all about the necessity of having a preacher. Now, we should probably point out that what it means when it says to the Jew first and also to the Greek. Another way of understanding that is to the Jew first and equally to the Greek. So Paul is not saying here that, the Jews in some way are more important, or Greeks are, and Greek here is just another way of saying Gentile, non-Jew, are less important. It's not about importance. It's literally about the order of, I mean, the Jews have been God's chosen people. They're the ones who have the oracles of God, as he'll go on to show, the scriptures. And so they're utterly aware of what he's talking, but they've got a head start, so to speak, in the talk about the Messiah and the talk about what the Savior will do. But it is indeed equally for both Jew and Gentile.
Yeah, this is, he's essentially saying who believes to, of course, the Jews and yes, also the Greeks.
Right. So that's the way to understand that. It's not necessary. It's not talking about, you know, who's more important or anything like that. It's just saying it's for everybody. This gospel is the power of salvation to everyone who believes. Everyone who believes. So in the word for believe, you know, you can, it just means trust. And then you get to the second for statement, or because. Again, you can understand that word for is because. So it's giving a reason for why Paul's not ashamed of the gospel. The second reason, for in it, this gospel, the righteousness of God is revealed from faith for faith, as it is written, the righteous shall live by faith. Now, why is the righteousness of God, why do we need that to be revealed, and why is that so significant?
We need it to be revealed for a couple of reasons. First and foremost, we need to have the righteousness of God revealed so that we can know that we're not righteous.
Mm-hmm.
So this is sort of the to be exposed in our unrighteousness. But we also need it revealed. It's revealed in the person of Christ and revealed and bestowed. And this is kind of what he's talking about. The righteousness of God is revealed as something that we could never have on our own, something that God possesses, and then is revealed from faith for faith. This is to say that he comes and he gives us that righteousness via faith. And there's this weird cyclical thing that happens then, that it's given by faith or from faith for faith, and that without faith, it is impossible to please God. This is what the author of Hebrews says.
Yes.
So faith is required for righteousness. You have to believe God to be righteous. If you don't believe God, you are not righteous, because it's sinful to doubt God. So what happens is you are given faith that you could believe in the promises of God, made righteous, and that righteousness also gives faith. And this is like ever happening, this cyclical thing.
That's right. And I think also another way of understanding it is to hear it as from faith to faith. In other words, it never stops being by faith that righteousness is attained or revealed to you.
Mm-hmm.
So and this is really important, because the tendency of every one of us, it's not just a particular group, it's every human being, is to think of it in these terms. Christian life starts with faith, and then we take that for granted, we kind of set it aside, and it becomes about working, it becomes about maintaining whatever you were given. So you've got to sort of live up to the righteousness that you were given initially. And this, of course, creates people that are insecure or legalistic. They all kind of spring from the same thing. And what Paul is going to go on to show in the rest of the letter is that no. It's from faith from beginning to end.
Yeah.
It never stops being just trust.
Yeah, and it's by gifted faith from beginning to end. Or as, you know, the great theologian Journey says, don't stop believing.
The great theologian Journey.
That's what this is about, man.
Yes, indeed.
And then he goes on and quotes the Old Testament. It says, as is written, the righteous shall live by faith. Or by faith the righteous shall live, or the just shall live. And this is sort of a double meaning thing too, I think, where it means that your whole life is one of faith, one of believing in the promises of God, believing that your righteousness is from God, but also that it's by faith that you will obtain eternal life. This is why Paul says it is the power for salvation to everyone who believes.
Yeah, and this is a quote from the prophet Habakkuk, chapter 2, verse 4, for those who would like to go back and read it. The context, we won't go into it here, but the context is wonderful because it's in the context of a complaint about how God can dwell in the midst of sinners and how he can deal with, what is his solution for those who have rebelled and are evil. And the answer is, eventually, the righteous shall live by faith. And so it fits perfectly in with what Paul is about to go into, which is to expose everyone for being indeed evil and right, unworthy of fellowship with God.
Exactly.
So with that said, let's move on to verse 18. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth. For what can be known about God is plain to them because God has shown it to them. For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that have been made, so they are without excuse. Let's just stop there. First of all, what does it mean to suppress the truth?
To push it back.
Yeah, this idea, I mean, if you get the idea of like trying to, push like a spring down or something like that, you're pushing something down, but it's putting force up against you. Like, you know it's there. You know what you're doing. Is the idea. Like, you're suppressing something that you know.
This is essentially lying to yourself. I mean, not only do you know people who have done this in other ways, where you're like, well, you know, maybe you know somebody who has, an addiction. And they're like, I don't have an addiction.
Yeah.
That's the suppression
of the truth.
And you know that they know that they have an addiction. You know.
Yeah, deep down in their heart, they know it. Yeah.
Yeah, and they won't admit it. They won't confess it. So you know people like that. But more than that, you know that you do this.
Yeah.
You know that there's things about you that you suppress. That you're like, I'm not like that.
Yeah.
That's not me.
Yeah. This is the human condition.
Yes. Yes. And you have I like the language of this sort of double revealing that you have. The righteousness of God is revealed, and he says the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men. So in the revelation of the righteousness of God, the wrath of God is revealed against that which is not righteous,
yeah,
which is not altogether good.
And we'll find out that really is, that's everybody.
Yes.
When he says, for what can be known about God is plain to them because God has shown it to them. And he goes on to say that you can see the evidence of God in the creation of the world. Now, it is interesting. I mean, number one, I think Paul is making a brief case here that no matter what, there's really no such thing as a true atheist.
Right.
I mean, in other words, everybody knows there's a God instinctively, by nature. They know there is a God.
They know that there's at least something to be investigated.
There's something. Yeah. And there's but they don't know much about it. So I mean, what he does say God reveals, he says his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived. Well, so that doesn't tell us anything about the gospel. The God of nature, or the God that we see revealed in the design of the universe per se, we don't really know much about from looking at nature.
Well, I think it goes like this. All that is known, known, everything that is clearly perceived does this. It certainly tells you that you are not God and that there is something else.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, you ought not live like you are God.
Yes.
And this is sort of the baseline that everyone's at. You didn't create all this. You don't have the power to bring this into existence. There is something else. And you live as if there is nothing else but you. And you don't seek out this God. You don't investigate this God. He will go on to say, so he says that they're without excuse. It's, you know, people will ask you this, you know, like, oh, do people stand condemned who, you know, didn't have, what about people that never even had the law? They weren't told to honor their father and mother. They weren't told. Well, Paul will say
this is the old noble savage argument.
Yeah, but Paul will say, like, they're not actually going to be held according to the letter of the law because they don't have it. But what he is saying is that they're guilty nonetheless of this.
Yeah, and he'll even go on to say that, you know, Romans chapter 2, he'll talk about the fact that the law of God is written on the conscience.
Mm-hmm.
So even those that don't have the written letter of the law, they have some sense of what is right and what is wrong, and they know that they violated it.
Right.
They know that they haven't lived up to what they should, whether you're raised in a home with the Ten Commandments on the wall or whether you've never heard them before in your life. There is this sense, this universal sense that God has put into the heart of man in which we know what we ought to do and we don't do it.
Yeah, so God doesn't judge all of creation by the Ten Commandments by the letter, but he will judge Israel that way, and Paul will make that clear. But he will judge the world in accordance to their conscience. If you want to know if this is true, I can tell you that I have had numerous conversations with unbelievers, and I don't mean just people that don't believe the gospel, but people that deny the existence of God. And I ask them this, and they say that they don't need forgiveness. And what I say is that okay, well, you don't acknowledge, you know, the law of God or anything like that, but have you ever done anything that you're ashamed of? And I have yet to have anyone tell me no. Not once. Like, have you ever done anything that you're ashamed of? And they say, of course. Like, have you ever apologized to someone? Have you ever gone to someone and said, I'm sorry? And they're like, of course. I'm like, well, then you acknowledge that you are not as you should be.
Yeah.
This is universal.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. And so that's why Paul goes on. I mean, you sort of see this, like, in this passage, it's almost like a spiral downward. You know, I mean, you keep on going. It says, for although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him, but they became futile in their thinking and their foolish hearts were darkened. Claiming to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man and birds and animals and creeping things. So not only do you know that there's a God, but ignore him, but you also decide to worship false gods in his place.
Yeah, so a little bit what Paul's doing here is he's giving you a little bit of a history lesson, because you might be like, I didn't do that. Like, I don't know anybody doing that. And what he's saying is from in the beginning, like if you go way back to where this decline started, these people had heard about God. They knew about him. They did not honor him. They didn't give thanks to him. And they became futile in their thinking, so futile that they exchanged the glory of God for actually carved images and made up gods and thought they were all wise in doing so. They came up with these clever gods and this sort of thing. And so he's saying, like, look, this is how this happened in the past. And even in that day, people still had carved gods and this sort of thing.
Sure.
But what's going on theologically is that you might not acknowledge God because you might think that you're too smart for that.
Mm-hmm.
Too wise to acknowledge the actual creator God, but you're worshiping something else.
Yeah. Luther, in his large catechism on the first commandment, talks about this, and he says that basically whatever you trust in and put faith in, put hope in, is your God. It can be anything. I mean, idolatry looks, it very, very rarely looks nowadays like building a statue, but it does look like putting your hope in, you know, your retirement account. It does look like making, you know, putting your hope in the well-being of your kids or your spouse or whatever, to the point where that becomes your ultimate, end. Like that's what you live for.
Yeah, dude. And we do this with all kinds of, eventually he'll say, that you worship the creation rather than the creator. He's getting to that. But and the truth is, I lived in Seattle for a while, which is a city that broadly believes in justification via recycling. And that's,
New York City has that in common.
Yeah, so that's a real thing. And not that I have anything against recycling. I think that we should be stewards of the planet. I'm not making
it. It just doesn't justify you before the sight of God?
No, it does not. So be a good steward of the planet. That's a good idea. But for sure, you see some idolatrous stuff going on.
Oh, yeah.
Where, like a lot of this is done, and we do this too. You come up with an idea that you think is like a very good thing, indeed a righteous thing.
Yeah.
Save the earth, save the whales. And I'm all down for saving all the
saving
things.
Some polar bears and some whales?
Let's save them.
Let's do that.
But for sure, we are like, that's a good thing. That's a righteous thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, once you start investing these things with a sense of your own righteousness, which, we do so subtly. We're not even aware we're doing it. But basically, we are, I'll put it this way. We are born hungering. We cannot live without trying to find a way to be declared righteous by something we do.
That's right.
And what the gospel is going to do, and what Paul is in the process of doing, and we'll have to pick up a lot of this next week, most of it next week, is Paul is going to dismantle any idea that you're going to contribute to the righteousness you actually need. That's all got to come from God gratis.
Right. And so the text is, we'll end with this text, but the text is in verse 24, where he says, therefore God gave them up to the lust of their hearts, to impurity, to the dishonoring of their bodies among themselves, because they exchanged the truth about God for a lie and worshiped and served the creature rather than the creator, who is blessed forever. Amen. What you end up doing there is you dismiss God, you come up with other gods, specifically creation is what he's talking about here, so created things, and you make that your God. And we see this happen, that if people don't have the same stances that you have, whatever it is, now this we see a lot of this gets politically charged, but this could be right or left, but people who have made political positions and environmental positions or any other positions their God.
Justice positions.
Whatever it is.
You name it.
And the reason you know that there's righteousness on the line in these things is that the person who disagrees with you, whoever it is, they aren't just somebody who has a different opinion than you on something. They are immoral.
Yeah. That's correct.
You are righteous and they are not.
Yeah. They're satanic.
Yes. And
you're on the side of the, you're on the quote side of history.
Right. And so
you want to use the language.
Yeah. And so what happens here is, you know, when that much righteousness is at stake in these things, that this is indeed where you are resting your salvation.
Yeah. And this is why we desperately need the gospel, because even after becoming Christians, Dan, this tendency doesn't go away for us.
That's right. That's right. And that's where we got to end it, because that's 30 minutes, but Paul is going to ramp it up more. If you thought that was all of the exposing work he has to do,
he's going to roast us for the next couple of weeks here.
Yeah. Prepare to be fried. It is coming. Eric, yeah. I look forward to being terminated along with you and then raised back to life.
All right. Sounds good, I guess.
All right. See you next week.
See ya.